Well, thank you all for coming. Thank you, Abby, for the introduction. I did want to make a couple of comments. I think as we initiate this conference, it's important for us to understand some of the policy objectives that the legislature has put in place over the last couple of years and some of the hurdles and challenges that we face going forward as we seek to develop South Dakota's wind resource. And the Lieutenant Governor actually put his finger on it early when he said that we have this tremendous resource in South Dakota, but we don't actually need the power here. So essentially the opportunity that we have and the policy objectives that the legislature and the governor's office have worked together to pursue over the last couple of years is the opportunity to see South Dakota truly develop as a source of generation, or see the industries around power generation develop in South Dakota and make South Dakota a significant power exporter and supplier of power for lots of other regions in this country. And certainly as we've seen climate change issues start to rise on the priority list, that wind resource in particular grows even more important. At this conference held last year in November of 06, we talked about South Dakota's resource along with other states in the region. And when we decided, really, I think from that conference with Dale's help, that we would do conferences focused on more specific geographical areas, one of the things that we commented on is the common phrase we hear, that South Dakota has the potential to be the Saudi Arabia of wind. And I think it's important for us to recognize that Saudi Arabia's oil reserves were not developed, have not been exploited for their local market. It is, in fact, the world market that has allowed Saudi Arabia to become a player in the global oil supply business. And I think that's a model we need to continue to remember here. It's not South Dakota's electricity demand that limits the growth of our power generation industry. It's the opportunity we have to supply that power to other places around the country. Are we getting closer? All right. Let's start with Steve. Go ahead.
In case some slides come up. So most of you have something in front of you that looks like a package, and it's a bunch of slides in there. And mine are identifiable by the fact that my name is on them. So somewhere I found them on the left-hand side of my package, if you guys look there. Yep, Steve Lindenberg is on the package. So I'll start there. I'm going to try to describe a sort of general idea across the nation. So even though we're going to focus on South Dakota to a great extent today, I'm going to talk about what would 20% of the nation's electric supply look like if we did it from wind energy. We aren't anywhere near that today. As somebody, I think Abby maybe mentioned earlier, we're about 1% or thereabouts. So why would we do this? The reason is that the president, in his State of the Union address in 2006, laid out something called the Advanced Energy Initiative that is focused around a number of renewable technologies, including liquid fuels and electric supply, and mentioned solar, wind, and geothermal energy processes in that theme. We heard at that time that perhaps 20% of the nation's electric energy could come from wind, and we joined together with the American Wind Energy Association, the national laboratories that are supported by the Department of Energy, and ourselves with some other partners to try to explore that possibility. So on my slide two, the real question is, what would 300 gigawatts of electric energy look like if you were going to build it from wind across the United States? Is this feasible? We had questions along the lines of, do we have enough labor? Have we got the right manufacturing capability? Are there even enough raw materials, steel and copper and concrete and other things? Half of the cement in the world goes to China on an annual basis. So just trying to find cement for foundations was not necessarily straightforward. We also wanted to take a look at estimating both the cost and the benefits of such a program, and I'll talk to you about those today. So were there going to be major hurdles? We needed to find that out. On slide three, I've got advantages of the 20% wind energy vision. We would have a cleaner energy portfolio if we had a large amount of renewables in it. We would have a sustainable, domestic, and secure fuel source for the future, whether we were using wind or solar. Greenhouse gases would be reduced. All of these are great advantages. We'd also be reducing some water use. We'd have an affordable, developable product here in the United States. Going over to slide four, cost and benefit highlights. I'm going to talk to you later about how big the greenhouse gas reduction is. It's really pretty significant. Water consumption is also. A lot of new jobs. The theory would be that it would be too expensive to move these large pieces of equipment around the world. And if you had a really significant market in the United States, there is every good reason to believe that manufacturers would either be homegrown or move here from places like Europe and the East Pacific Rim. We would do a great deal to reduce natural gas. I'll explain that a little bit later. And there would be a relatively small increment of cost. As Charlie told us earlier, our best guesstimate today is something like $4 a gigawatt hour would be an additional cost in the energy expense. However, we're going to build a bunch of new generation unless all of us do a great deal more with energy efficiency. We are expecting that between now and 2030, the focus date of this study, something like a 30 to 40% increase in demand for electricity. To meet that demand, we're going to have to build perhaps closing in on 400 gigawatts of baseload generation, and we're talking about 300 gigawatts here of wind. People say, well, aren't you going to use up all the space? The truth is that because of our capacity factor, that we don't run 100% of the time at full capacity, there's still a lot of demand for other sorts of energy supplies to fit into the marketplace. How are we doing? All right. Now all I have to do is figure out this button system, right? Got it. All right. So here's the real meat of our study. This is an analysis that was done by Black & Veatch Engineering out of Kansas City. It was paid for by the folks at AWEA. And they took a look at how much wind energy is there available in the United States. This is really the low-cost portion of that rather large curve. Somewhere between 3 and 10,000 gigawatts is available. We've taken 1,000 gigawatts and represented it here. So everybody in this room is not familiar with all these terms. A kilowatt is about what you're running when you do have a home hairdryer. If you multiply that a couple of times by zeros, you get to a megawatt, and a megawatt is about the size of the modest turbines, utility-scale turbines. They're now getting bigger than that, up to 2.5 megawatts. But 1 megawatt wind turbine will supply about 300 homes. This chart is in gigawatts, which is 1,000 megawatts. And what we need to reach is somewhere around the 300. Am I getting a dot here? You see 200 and 400? Right in here, around 300 gigawatts is what we're going to have to build. And if you notice on the left-hand side, that says it's somewhere around $60 a megawatt hour. You might write that down, because later I'm going to come back to that. $60 is a little more expensive than market today. The market's around 48. And so there's a cost associated with doing this in using wind. However, new generation is going to be higher than the cost of the current market. So what do we have to do? This is what our growth would look like. The blue line is the continuous increase in wind generation across the United States nameplate capacity. And we get up to something like 300 gigawatts. On the right-hand side, we're looking at the growth on an annual basis. And you'll notice in the first years, we're not going to grow very quickly because we have to build up manufacturing, we have to get transmission into place, we've got to do a great deal of effort to get this going. But our intentions would be in the last 10 years or so of a period from 2020 to 2030 to be growing at a rate of something like 15, 14 gigawatts on an annual basis. It trails off a little bit in this analysis because at that point in time, we would begin to replace some of the earliest equipment, which has about a 20 to 25-year life. The intentions of this model were to make sure that we had a stable utility industry manufacturing, maintenance, and operation marketplace so that we didn't have a boom and then a bust with a lot of people losing their jobs. In those last 10 years of this period, we have something like 500,000 people working directly in manufacturing, construction, and operations and maintenance of wind generation in the United States. So what does that look like when you spread it out across the country? You'll want to focus on South Dakota, I'm sure, but you'll see that in a lot of places, we're going to build a great deal of wind. This is not necessarily something that's going to be captured by a couple of states. There are advantages to having wind closer to load. And so except for the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, where the wind is not a very good resource, most of the states in the union are going to have some wind generation. Now, some places, like South Dakota, will have a roughly 5 to 10 gigawatts is our best guess. But there will be places that will have smaller amounts closer to their sites. And it's a matter of the marketplace and the cost of the development of that energy. As Charlie's talked about, Charlie Smith just before this speech, you have to move that around. And this, again, is the AEP concept of how you might be able to do that. Charlie did a very nice job of explaining this. AEP, for those of you not aware of the utility industry, is, if not the largest, one of the largest electric utilities in the United States. And it's the only one that currently operates at the high voltage of 765 kV. In their Ohio and Indiana arena, they already have, as shown in red here, several hundreds of miles of 765 kV operating transmission lines. They are very big lines. They are not something you miss on the landscape, but they run in a location that is, you know, predictable and manageable. It would take a lot to build this out. Charlie described this roughly $60 billion, and we wouldn't do it overnight. But a system like this could be very, very effective at moving energy around the United States. So what happens if we build all those turbines and we put in this transmission? What's some of the benefits that come to us as a nation? One of them is carbon dioxide reductions. You'll see here that we increase over time in the carbon dioxide taken out of the energy generation arena of electric utility operations. And by the time we get to 2030, it's roughly 25% of the otherwise emitted gases that would be reduced by this amount of wind energy being put into the national grid. If we did it all with coal and oil, we'd produce that much more in the way of carbon emissions. Now I want to get back to the $60 that I talked about earlier, which was our estimated general cost to get to that 300 gigawatts. If you look here on the far right side, what we're saying is if you put some sort of a reasonable value, and many people have argued for many years about what a reasonable value is for carbon, but some estimates would put it somewhere around $18 or $20 a megawatt hour for carbon reductions. You could take that $18 or $20 a megawatt hour and you could put it back against the $60 a megawatt hour that you're paying if there was a carbon cost at that time factored into the national electric utility operation. And so either fossil fuel generation would be higher, or perhaps we would get some sort of a benefit for non-emitting generation sources that would help to offset those costs of wind at extra expense. If we look at fuel cost, some carbon I'm sorry, I've gone too far. I have no control. There we go. All right. Fuel savings. We're going to offset a lot of natural gas, and we're going to offset some coal by operating wind to supply energy. And in that process, if you, again, you go through a series of evaluations and estimates, you find that perhaps somewhere around $20 of fuel cost savings occurs across the industry for the use of wind instead of transporting fossil fuels. So again, you have the opportunity to offset either the expense of the other electric operations in fossil fuel generation, or you can get some value for wind that helps you to offset that $60 cost that we had earlier. Water is another important aspect. You don't use any water, and frankly, where the wind blows in this country is often very arid. You guys know about that around here. And the circumstances are that we would save a good deal, perhaps 4 trillion gallons of water by the time we get to 2030, and that's about enough to run the city of Denver for something on the order of 100 years. That counts. That makes a big difference in the West. 100 years of water supply for a municipality the size of Denver, Colorado, as it exists today, would make a difference in the coming years. What about jobs? In manufacturing, we think there's going to be work all over the country. It's both in building components as well as things that you see, obviously, like wind blades and towers, turbine towers. But the bottom line is perhaps something like 1,000 to 5,000 jobs would come along with that 5 to 10 gigawatts of wind that would be built here in the state of South Dakota. I'm sure that those would be very welcome, and there'd be a lot of families who would enjoy having their families stay in the state to see the grandkids grow up and watch the family mature. So there's a great deal of benefit associated with this technology development if we can get it to happen. Now, a lot of folks will say, well, this is just pie in the sky. Well, you know, if we can't dream, what can we do? We ought to be thinking about what we can possibly accomplish. But we're not the only folks who are thinking this way. The states of California, Minnesota, and Oregon have already done studies to look at 20, 25, 30% of their energy coming from renewables. And a good deal of that is aimed today at wind. If breakthroughs occur in other kinds of technology, they will probably be competitive in market as well. The state of Denmark today is about 25% of their electric energy supply comes from wind. And they are aiming to develop a system that gets more than 50% of their electric supply coming from wind. And they intend, as you suggested, Joel, to export to a whole bunch of other people in Northern Europe. They like to sell electricity like everybody else does. Germany and Spain are on track to be aiming at 15 or so percent in a reasonable time frame, and they're already in the 7 to 9% today. the CREZ zones in Texas and efforts in Colorado, California, and New Mexico, where renewable energy zones are being identified or are being discussed, is another indication that people are talking about building big. Those zones tend to run in the several thousand megawatt scale. So perhaps over several townships, tens of townships, you would see a scale of 2 to 4 gigawatts of wind built out over the next few years. The Western governors have got their CDAC report, and they're talking about 30 gigawatts of renewables in the West. If you take all the RPSs across the country and add them up and do some estimates, you get around 75 gigawatts of wind or other renewables that will be necessary to fill the renewable portfolio standards. The European Union has set out a plan to replace 20% of all of its energy with renewables by 2020. So they're going to work on not only electricity, but also liquid fuels and try and replace all of that in that time frame. The Midwestern governors have recently signed a platform that aims at getting at very serious reductions in carbon and increases in renewables. So there's many people who are working in this direction. Here's our bottom line. Wind energy will provide 20% of electricity needs by 2030, securing America's leadership in reliable, clean energy technology using an inexhaustible, affordable, and domestic resource. We think that's possible. We've worked very hard for a year and a half with 100 people, roughly, trying to understand whether this can be accomplished, and we have a belief that it's possible. But it will take fortitude to get there, and it will take a lot of people working, and it will take some commitment from governments, from the federal down to the local, to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And as Dave is getting ready, I'll just take a minute to remind everybody that we will go through the presentations first, and then we will open up to questions of all the presenters after we've heard the five presentations.
Testing 1, 2. I can't use this. Sorry. I'll go with this. Thanks a lot. I'm Dave Corbis from the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Today I'm going to talk about the Eastern Wind Integration and Transmission Study. You heard Steve talk about kind of the large picture throughout the nation, and now we're going to focus down to what happens in a certain region. So I'll be incorporating some of the concepts from Charlie's talk and focusing down on the eastern region and talking about this study. You got it? I'd like to acknowledge my co-conspirator in this, Matt Sugar, who is here. If you have questions, Matt is here as well. You can address myself or Matt during the breaks as well. Again, the concept here is to go from looking at a regional analysis throughout a large part of the Midwest all the way to the East Coast and moving the energy from the heartland of America, where the wind resource is, South Dakota, and how do we get it to the load centers. And what we need to do is a pretty complex study, and we do a rigorous study. And so I'll go through that, and it'll touch on a lot of these concepts in wind energy that we've talked about so far. I'm just going to go proceed. The slides will catch up with me. Eastern Wind Integration and Transmission Study, EWITS. Not the greatest acronym. Now, we originally were going to call it the Novel and Innovative Technology for Wind Integration and Transmission. But that didn't work. That was nitwits. What am I going to do? And then, because DOE is founding this study, we want to put DOE in there, so we came up with an acronym, dimwits. That didn't work either. So as we didn't want to be dim-witted nitwits, so we are going with EWITS, Eastern Wind Integration and Transmission Study. So our objective here is to look at what has to happen, and how do we analyze 20% wind over this eastern region that we're looking at, and 30% wind? Because again, this is where a lot of the great wind resources is, so we want to look at a 30% wind scenario too. Those two scenarios, and looking at over a region. And what are we looking at? We're looking at a lot of those concepts Charlie talked about. What impact will wind have for 20 and 30% energy? On the how will wind impact power systems? How will it act from the variability of the wind and the uncertainty? When's it going to blow? Again, remember, wind is a variable resource. We can't push a button and turn it on. So we're going to look at how does that wind affect the operability and the reliability of the grid? How does it affect transmission? So those are the things that we'll be studying in the EWITS study. Charlie talked about a lot of other wind integration studies, and there's been some great ones to date. One in Minnesota, New York. He put a whole list of them together. So what this study seeks to do is to expand and do one of those wind integration studies on a larger scale. So we really need to look and see what happens with this wind deployment over a large regional scale. There is a sister study to this called the Western Wind Integration and Solar Study, that has already kicked off, and this is the counterpart, the Eastern Wind Integration Study. Back up about 3-4 slides. Keep going. Two more. Okay, yeah. All right, so we're coordinating this work, and this is with the Joint Coordinated System Plan, and Dale Osborne of MISO will be talking about that. We're coordinating that with their study, so you'll hear this Joint Coordinated System Plan come up. And it's a really exciting team. I'm really proud to be part of it and working with Dale and this group. It's MISO, PJM, SPP, TVA, those regional electric entities. And our study will work and dovetail with their study, and we'll hear about that. But again, we're looking at 20 and 30% energy in 2024, building upon these other studies that we've done. And our goal is to produce a study that's really meaningful and very technically rigorous. We'll have a technical review committee that goes over the assumptions. Again, we're really using a lot of state-of-the-art methodologies and planning tools and modeling to come up with this. And so what I'll do is talk about that study now. What are the key questions? What do we want to answer? And real briefly, we want to look at this scenario where we have all this wind in the Midwest, and how do we get it to the load centers? We want to answer some different questions. Does it make sense to take wind in the heartland of America and bring it to New York City? How did the cost benefits of that trade off with using local wind resources that might not be as high a wind resource but are closer to the load centers? What are the benefits? What are the transmission requirements? And then we also want to look at this whole concept of geographical diversity. And I'm going to take a minute just to... Charlie touched on that. Geographical diversity. Well, when the wind blows, the wind power goes. But when you average that out over a whole region, when you average that out over the whole Midwest, it makes it a lot more manageable. It's not as spiky. It's damped out, right? Imagine blowing out a huge birthday cake. You can't blow the wind all in one spot at the same time. The same thing with this large region. That's why it's important to do a large regional study where we're looking at this concept of geographical diversity, how the wind averages out over time over the study. So that's a key part of the study that I want to kind of... You need to kind of keep in the back of your mind. So a couple things we'll look at here real quickly. What are the operational and costs imposed by this variability of wind on this large deployment? That's important to know that. Important to look at that. What is the role of wind forecasting is something we look at. Charlie talked about forecasting. Forecasting hour ahead, day ahead is very important, and it helps integrate wind in and lower the costs and make it more manageable. So we'll look at that in the study. We also look at, as Charlie mentioned about, he talked about areas that you look at the market over. And as you expand that market area, you do balancing area consolidation. Again, it allows wind to play in a different manner. So we'll look at that sensitivity. And we'll also look at fast markets outside of the MISO market. But what happens if fast markets are in this whole footprint? What are some of the outcomes of wind? And that's what you need to look at when you look at wind. It's not real simple. You got to look in it. You got to do the detailed assessment on a regional basis. And that's all about. I'm just going to go through these real quick. Just to give you an idea what we do here is we really have to take the wind and compare it to what's happening with the load. Okay, the wind is producing power, and the load is taking that power. So what we do on these wind integration studies is we generate 3 years of wind data through a very rigorous weather modeling approach and analysis. And so we have hourly data for 3 years. So if you go back to 2006, January 2nd, 10 a.m., I know what the wind speed is through this whole region in the Midwest out to the East Coast. And I also know what the load is. So we get a net load. You can subtract that wind generation from your load. And then you can look at exactly what's happening and march through time. So it's a very rigorous analysis, and it answers these questions that are so important for this regional context of wind, as Steve talked about, on a regional level, 20%, 30%. And again, I touched on forecasting and balancing area. So let me go ahead and tell you about the three key tasks. And this is going to, it kind of goes from weather modeling all the way to electrons flowing into your toaster. So the first task is mesoscale modeling. Mesoscale, what's that? That's when you take a huge weather model and you run it for most of the eastern half of the United States. You go down to 2 kilometers because you want to get all the effects of terrain, a little gorge here, it's going to affect your wind. 10-minute time. You do that for 3 years. And that, my friends, is what's called supercomputing power. They use supercomputers to run these models. They generate about 50 terabytes of data. Now, you're not going to fit 50 terabytes of data in your back pocket. Lots of data. We take that data, and then we generate sites from that data. We know where the wind speed is throughout this whole region, and then we bring in a site selection. We convert that wind speed to power, and then we say, we bring in a geographical information system, GIS overlay, whereas there are exclusion areas, you can't have wind turbines on a federal exclusion area, and you start to see the shape of what this vision that Steve talked about, 20% energy, 30% energy by wind, what does that look like on a state-by-state basis, and where is that wind power being generated based on the weather modeling? And that's the first part. And then we take that, we give it, work with the MISO guys, give them that data, and they put that into a transmission analysis. And they say, how can that wind be transmitted? What does it look like? What are the costs? And the third step is to go ahead and take that output from the markets and models and the hourly model dispatch run and find out, answer those questions about what are the costs, additional costs for using wind energy because of this uncertain variability, and also what are the impacts on reliability, because that's very important. Reliability, key issue. Let's talk about them real quick. There's our footprint area. MISO, PJM, SPP, TVA, and South Dakota is included there. We're not going to leave you guys out. Fourth largest wind resource? No way. You guys are in there. Nebraska's in there. Now, if you're in white, if you're in a state from on the map that is in white, don't worry. The meteorological guys will probably run a larger area. That's just the way they do it. They cut the country up, and they run that big weather model to tell you what the wind speeds are going to be for this large area. But that's our modeling area that we will run the mesoscale modeling for. Now, when they run the transmission analysis, they'll run it for that whole eastern interconnect, the whole eastern area, because the transmission model will go ahead and model that whole flow throughout the area. And then for task three, when we come back and do the actual integration study, we'll be back to this footprint. Just an aside, but that's the area we're looking at. Again, some of the best wind resources in our nation right there. How do we work with them? So we identify those wind power sites I talked about, and we want to have a little more than we really need so we can play the shell game. We want to have 300 gigawatts of wind power sites identified, and then we can say, well, what happens if we put mega sites in this part, 5,000 megawatt wind farm? We're talking about a 4,000 megawatt in Texas, the biggest there's ever been. What happens if we split the wind resources up, put some over in Pennsylvania, put some here? So we want to look at those two scenarios, 135 gigawatts in that footprint area for 20% energy. The mystery slide. Doesn't want to come up. Okay. The second, very interesting. Okay. The second part, we'll have a look at that slide. Imagine a transmission analysis over that area that takes that information and runs it through an hourly dispatch and looks at the markets and the cost of electricity. And you can see the slides on page. So you can see the prices of electricity is very different. If you look at that darker prices on the left in the Midwest, the price of electricity are less. Can you move that energy to those higher price markets on the East Coast? And how does that work? So we'll run an hourly production cost model. And again, this is coordinated, and Dale's group at MISO will be running the hourly dispatch model to model those wind power flows on the grid. All right, that's the second one, the dispatch. And And then thirdly is the evaluation of the actual impacts on the grid. What happens, again, and Charlie brought up these three time frames. One was regulation, seconds to minutes. How is the grid being affected by this wind power on the grid in the seconds to minutes? How is it affecting your frequency control, your AGC, and your generators maintaining synchronization? And then we look at load following, minutes to hours. How does that load following, how does the ramp up in the afternoon or the ramp down? Again, imagine the worst case scenario here. The wind blowing at night very strongly throughout the Midwest and a very low load. So you could have a very high penetration of wind power, and you need to control those the wind in those different time periods on the regulation time period, on the load following, and then what are you going to commit the next day? What's going out in terms of what kind of generators and spinning reserve fossil generators you need to run, okay, and how does your forecast work into that, your wind forecast? And then finally, how does that affect your reliability? Because again, reliability is so key in this field. So those are the three main tasks. Came back. There's my load following capability slide. So again, regulation, load following in the middle, scheduling out towards the right, and how this wind power affects reliability on the grid. That's what we're looking at. Those three key tasks, all the way from the mesoscale weather modeling to siting that wind power for that 20%, 30% energy scenario, to looking at the transmission, how that power gets to the load, and then looking at how that affects the costs and the impacts on the grid and the reliability. We have a technical review committee. I'll just go over really quickly. Again, once the wind integration contractor is specified, we'll put together a technical review committee, and that'll be a very rigorous committee that reviews with us, gives us feedback, et cetera. This is a very open process, and we really want your input to the process. The study is starting, and your input is important for us as we go through this, and the TRC will be the formal way to get this. The schedule is shown here. I mentioned the Western Wind Integration and Solar Study has already started, and this is kicking off now. We can't talk about the mesoscale modeling too much because the bids are already in. We're about to award that, and then we'll be awarding the other contract. And then we'll supply this wind data to the MISO group and the Joint Coordinated System Planning for their transmission analysis. So we're really working hard to get that data to them. And we originally going to model the whole Eastern Interconnect. We had to scope it down for budget and because of time to fit in with that study. So your input is important on the study methodology, on the scope, scenarios, transmission analysis. Matt is here. I'm here as well to talk to you about that. And those are our emails. Feel free to email us. And we look forward to working with you on that study. Thanks. I have one other public service announcement by DOE, and that is there is a wind integration opportunity. Western is partnering with NREL on a cost share program. It's up to $200,000 is available to a Western utility customers interested in conducting this kind of study. So there's a website up there. You can contact Randy Mannion at DOE for more information. And there's going to be a webinar on December 6th at 11 a.m. Mountain Time. So you can go to that site if you're a Western utility and you're interested in pursuing one of these integration studies on a smaller basis for your region. This would be a good way to do it. Thanks.